Thank you for joining us for episode 73 of Project Geekology. I am one of your hosts, Anthony, and joining me as always is...
Dakota, everyone's third favorite fictional chronologist.
Is it third? Are you sure it's not first or second? At least first with MCU, right?
Actually, you'd be surprised. I'm actually not... Some people don't like my timelines. Like, there are people out there who are just like, Geek Critique, his followers are so cult-like, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, you get a lot of that in the deep depths of the MCU forums out there. But I will say... I started calling myself like the third favorite fictional chronologist just as a way to see how people react. When I started, funny enough, so I just finished writing my MonsterVerse timeline. It's the longest stupid thing I've ever written, 11,000 plus words, and it took me 2 hours to record it. That's what I was working on when, like, right before this, that, like, I had to keep pushing the start of this recording back and back and back. So hopefully, like, it'll come out to, like, you know, it'll probably come out to about, like, a 50-minute long video, but I'm really proud of it. But yeah, in that video that I inaugurate, everyone's third favorite fictional chronologist, that video.
Nice. I know that we usually start with what I've been up to. So what have you been up to in this period of time? Yeah. I know that you've been kind of out and about. You had spent some time traveling. We talked about that a little bit in the last podcast episode. But what have you been up to since then?
In terms of... Let's retract a little bit. This will all be, you know, still on the podcast. But we are covering a great film today, a Steven Spielberg movie, Saving Private Ryan. That's going to be the crux of our discussion today.
Yeah, how did I not mention that? That's crazy.
It's okay. It's certainly not a forgettable film, even though we forgot to mention it in our intro. But we'll get back to Saving Private Ryan and all like the incredible filmmaking stuff that went into it in a little bit. What I've been up to, not a whole lot since we were last on the show. Like I said, I finished writing and recording my MonsterVerse timeline. Now the goal is to release that before March 29th, which is when the new movie comes out. Godzilla X Kong, The New Empire. Or, you know, I just found out it was supposed to be pronounced Godzilla Kong, The New Empire. Like the X is supposed to be silent, which kind of bothers me. Like it looks... It sounds odd, but...
Right. There's a lot of stuff out there that's the same way. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen Hunter Hunter. That was, like, my initial thought.
Like, Spy but... Family. Yeah, it's a pretty common staple in, like, anime. But using that commonality in a title for a Hollywood movie is kind of weird for me. So it took a while to adjust to that. But yeah, so that's been the big thing that I've been working on. And I've been talking about it for weeks now. You guys are probably sick of hearing me talk about MonsterVerse stuff. But yeah, this is a huge project for me. I'm really, really excited about it. Now it's just like a race to the finish line to get it all edited before that movie comes out. Because the way the script is built is that it's like a primer for the new movie. You know, like it's supposed to be watched before the new movie. It's like everything, a history of the MonsterVerse leading into Godzilla, Kong, The New Empire. But yeah, so other than that, I watched the Netflix Avatar The Last Airbender series, which has been getting mixed reviews. Some people really like it, some people really don't. I'm in the camp that it's mostly good.
Yeah, I've seen it, and I will say that overall, I like it a lot more than the movie. The movie was just absolutely terrible.
Yeah. I mean, they clearly, when it comes to this show, you can tell that everyone behind the camera really loved the lore, and everyone in front of the camera knew their characters very well.
Have a little bit of a problem with that, because there is quite a bit that has changed as far as the lore.
Of course, yeah.
And that was a big problem for me. Okay. I would say that while a lot of it looked great, I liked that it dove a little bit deeper in what happened with the airbenders. And for me, there was a little bit of some weirdness. There's some weird casting choices for me. I feel like...
Okay. Yeah, there were some weird casting choices. Like Ozai's Angels, the Azula, Mei, and Ty Lee. I feel like they were miscast a little bit. Ty Lee kind of looks like her comic book or cartoon counterpart, but the other two don't.
Right. So that is my issue. Sokka is a little off-putting. And it's not so much with the acting. It's just he just looks so much older than he should.
Okay. I mean, Sokka was supposed to be the older of the three.
So Sokka is the older of the three, but like not by much, maybe like a couple years.
Yeah, I think he's 16.
Older than Katara, but he looks well over that. He looks like he's in his early 20s.
Okay. All right. That's a
Katara looks like her age. Aang looks like his age.
Yeah.
I think that they did pretty well. I'm not a fan of the lack of, oh my gosh, what is his name? Roku?
Yeah. They do have Roku in it. Have you finished watching?
Yes. No. Okay. So they do have Roku in it. I feel like there's a lot that was lacking as far as that. Because, I mean, we know what the story of Avatar The Last Airbender is. And Roku is actually such a huge, crucial individual for
part
that.
I mean, it is.
Because Aang is essentially cleaning up the mess that was left behind, you know?
Yeah. No, I 100% agree with that. Anthony, would you want to cover that next on our next podcast? Because I really think that we have different opinions about this in like an interesting way. Now, I don't think anything that I say is going to make you angry or anything you say is going to make me angry. But I think our differences in terms of our opinions are worth discussing on its own podcast. Do you want to like rewatch it and then come back fresh and just, you know, do a podcast on that?
Right. I think I do need to give it a rewatch because maybe some of my views will be a little bit lighter. Overall, I will say that I'm actually surprised that you have like such a positive outlook on it, because I mean, you are actually pretty, when it comes to reviewing, you're a little bit harsher than I am.
Here's the thing. I have friends who are in like the review circle, basically. Like they get all the shows early, they watch it. And, you know, every now and then, if it's a show that I'm really interested, I'll ask like, dude, how is this? And the first thing that I heard about this was that it was abysmal. Like it was the worst thing since sliced bread.
Yeah, no. See, I don't feel like it was abysmal.
It wasn't.
I feel like it was enjoyable. Flaws. Yeah, absolutely. It is enjoyable. It's a lot better than the movie. And it is fun. It is fun to watch. But there was so much that was changed to me, especially with certain characters, that honestly, I felt more disappointment than joy from watching this.
That's fair. I think we should table this discussion.
Absolutely. Yeah, because, yeah, we can get deeper into this.
It's still fresh to me. I could very easily just talk about Avatar for the rest of this podcast.
Yeah.
But I think that it deserves its own show. We need to talk about the Dragon Ball sized elephant in the room, the mangaka.
Well, that's kind of small. I mean, Dragon Balls are a little bit on the smaller
side. The Shenron sized dragon in the room. How about that?
Yes.
The mangaka Akira Toriyama, who is most famous for his work on Dragon Ball, Dragon Ball Z, and Super, as well as a number of other stuff, Dr. Slump,
Chrono Trigger, Dragon Quest, a lot of stuff.
He has passed away. Yeah, yes. He's passed away, sadly, at 68 or 69. It's a very young age for someone, you know, for anyone to die. It's too young.
Right. I think it was acute subdural hematoma.
Which, yeah, it's scary.
It's like
a
pulling in the brain, like the skull.
Yeah. So sadly, he passed away, and it kind of took the whole world by surprise. You know, it's one of those things that you're never expecting to hear. The creator of Dragon Ball died. Not that like anyone of us has any, you know, super close ties to him, but if you really think about like the impact that Dragon Ball had on pop culture, on our lives, you know, there'd be no One Piece, there'd be no Naruto, no My Hero Academia, no Bleach, none of that would exist if Dragon Ball wasn't a thing.
Shonen is what it is today because of Dragon Ball Z, you know.
100%.
And something that I was telling you, that, you know, the Dragon Ball series will always have a place in my heart. It will always stick with me because of what it did. It introduced me to the world of anime, and it made anime really like big in the West, man, at least for the United States. Because for sure.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. When, like, in the early 2000s, I believe it is when Toonami began, and they started syndicating these Japanese cartoons for American audiences, you know, in the wake of, like, the popularity of shows like Pokemon, you know, and they started syndicating Dragon Ball Z, Dragon Ball itself, Sailor Moon, Yu Yu Hakusho, all of these, like, you know, completely foreign shows to American audiences, but super developed in Japan, that kind of changed the face of American pop culture as well. And not only that, but like, you know, I didn't even realize like the impact it had on different countries. I'm looking, you know, like I've been like tuned into like the online discussion about like people of different races and how they were touched by Dragon Ball. Apparently Dragon Ball Z is huge in Black communities.
Oh, absolutely.
And yeah,
it's absolutely some of my like, you know, African American friends, they're really, really like hit by this. And yeah. I would say like another one that would probably stun them is if the creator of Naruto passes away.
Another crazy thing that happened is in Mexico. Mexico, apparently, that's like one of the biggest things in Mexico in terms of pop culture is Dragon Ball Z. So Mexican culture has been hit like crazy. Like if you look up Akira Toriyama, Mexico, you'll see like parades in the streets of like people in Saiyan costumes, just like dancing in like rural areas, just like, you know, in his memory. Apparently, like a bunch of the cartels called a ceasefire when like on his death. Like that's the level of insanity that Dragon Ball Z meant to these people. And you know what, respect to that. You always hear stories about like how crime went down when the Beatles played on the Ed Sullivan Show, and that's obviously a myth, but this is actually something that's causing crime to go down. That's like actually crazy.
That this is something that you can actually gauge.
A newsworthy headline. Yeah,
it's definitely a huge loss, you know. And he was still working on projects. There's another show that he was working on, and just a ton of other projects.
Yeah, what was the new show called? It was called Dragon Ball.
I think it started with a G, maybe.
Daima.
Dragon Ball Daima. Okay, as well. Yes, that's right.
I don't know if... Yeah, just October of 2023, Akira Toriyama is coming back for a new Dragon Ball series, Dragon Ball Daima. And I think it was a straight-to-anime show. I don't think it was being written as a manga, but I could be incorrect there. He's well-known for his manga stuff. And I've gone back and I've started rereading, like, the Dragon Ball manga that I have. And man, he's got such... You know, even, like, in his earliest stories of, like... Goku and Bulma and Oolong, Yamcha, Puar, like all these characters are so unique and the art style is so crisp and clear. I'd say it's like much more easy to follow reading wise than like a One Piece manga, just because the style is so much more easy to follow. But man, just a huge, huge loss for the anime, the manga community, and pop culture in general. I would put his influence on the wider pop culture world on the same level as, you know, like Walt Disney or Stan Lee in their respective mediums. You know, like Walt Disney is the pioneer of cartoon films, you know, and we see dozens of cartoon films come out every year nowadays. You know, that's right. That's an obvious influence from Walt Disney. You have Stan Lee, who created most of the biggest pop culture characters in cinemas these days, you know, or had some
and while manga and anime existed before DBZ and comics existed before Marvel, right, and cartoons existed before Disney, all these respected people did things to really revolutionize and bring in a golden era for comics, for cartoons. And I would say that the 90s was really jam-packed with anime and manga that a lot of people love. And yeah, man, like I said, the biggest reason why I had watched stuff like, you know, because I did watch a bit of Sailor Moon when I was younger, but that was because I was like, oh, this is kind of like the same, you know, art style as Dragon Ball Z. The same thing with Yu Yu Hakusho and Neon Genesis Evangelion and Cowboy Bebop. I kind of noticed that it was like, okay, it's a different type of cartoon. You just don't know how to name it. I thought that's how I saw them, was cartoons. I didn't know that it was called anime. I didn't really realize that it was Japanese. I just saw it as 100%. A cartoon.
Yeah. I'm in the same boat as you. I feel that, you know, when you're being introduced to that stuff as a kid, it did have a different level of maturity. And I think that's what these cartoons kind of brought to America in a way. You know, stuff like The Last Airbender couldn't exist without Dragon Ball Z, or, you know, just anime in general, and the shape of anime that was born out of that shonen style.
Right, like it doesn't treat its audience as unintelligent people.
Yeah, and I think that it's a lot more common in Japan for adults to watch anime than it is for adults to watch cartoons in America. I think it's just a much more common thing because, you know, anime being like one of Japan's biggest exports in terms of entertainment, probably their biggest export, it's built not just for kids. It's meant to be enjoyed by a wider range. And that's kind of the draw of the Dragon Ball franchise.
And anime in general, because I could see why it's easier to watch that in Japan as opposed to an adult watching cartoons here. Like, for me, there's no issue with watching cartoons. You like what you like. But a lot of the anime has, you know, it's more mature, it's more developed. And a lot of the cartoons is more geared for children. Except for, I mean, if you get shows like the Bad Batch, Clone Wars, it started off maybe a little bit on the childish side, but it really matures with its audience. Yep. Rebels is another. I know I'm naming just Star Wars, but honestly, Avatar The Last Airbender, I think what really grabbed me so much was that while it was a cartoon and while it had childish moments, the story was so amazing that I can easily call it probably my favorite cartoon. Like, original IP that exists outside of, that it's its own universe, that's not a part of anything else. It's its own thing.
With Avatar, and I think we've talked about this in the past. Well, I know we have in a couple our shows. But with Avatar, what's special is that I think it is actually geared towards children, but it doesn't shy away from hard-hitting stuff like freedom fighters actually being terrorists or
genocide.
Yeah. It doesn't shy away from that. It doesn't shy away from, you know, being the last of your kind, which is just like the worst possible thing that anybody could ever experience. It doesn't, and yeah, I'm just touching the surface, but like,
shy away from being emotional too, because there's a lot of moments that really hit you deep.
I think some people come into Avatar The Last Airbender expecting a show geared towards adults, but it isn't. It's a show geared towards children. So if you're watching it with the idea that it's a show geared towards adults in mind, you might not like it as much as someone who is just trying to appreciate what's being presented, what was allowed to be presented on Nickelodeon in the early 2000s.
Right.
It's something that changed the way kids think. And that all stems back to the Dragon Ball manga,
yeah,
you know. And so without going any further,
which I think that we should cover that at some point too, I'm Dragon Ball Z, because honestly, let's be real, Dragon Ball Z was definitely something that solidified our friendship too. That Harry Potter, maybe Final Fantasy, a lot of these things really, Star Wars obviously.
Remember in elementary school, Anthony, when kids would come with like folders full of like printed pictures of Dragon Ball Z? Or like Dragon Ball GT, and it was just like stuff that hadn't aired in the US yet, and it was just like, it was crazy, like looking at those images as like in, you know.
And they would draw them in class.
Yes, everybody used the models of Dragon Ball characters as inspiration to draw. I did it.
Dude,
I'm sure you did it.
Oh, dude, come on. I was one of those kids with the printed pictures drawing. This is real.
I was there too. I had my folder too. But anyway, yeah. So
yeah, we should definitely cover it.
There was sites back in the day where they would have like just pictures of Dragon Ball Z. It was just like a site dedicated to random pictures of Dragon Ball Z characters, blah blah blah, that everyone would use to
remember
to download
how hard stuff. It was to like
to
get
find
anime
that stuff
back then.
Oh my god, it's crazy. Huh? Like I can look up anything on my computer now and get it
like, on your phone, dude. Like I mean,
back
there's
then,
so many ways to find it. There's thousands of apps now. Like
I think it was called something like blueangel.com or something like that. I have a memory of like even like the layout of it. But anyway, I'm going off on a tangent. I think we should...
This podcast is a tangent, let's be real.
Yeah, really quickly. I know like you've kind of talked about what you've been up to as well, but anything else that you want to add before we jump into our discussion today?
Dune Part Dos. I saw it yesterday.
Oh, Dune Part Dos.
In IMAX.
Okay. Tell me.
Dude, so good. So good. Man, let me tell you, the IMAX and like those speakers, like I felt like I was going to shake, like right out of my seat. Like, it was so powerful, man. Like,
how's that scene when he first gets onto the sandworm and he's just like he's going through the sand and everything. Dude, it's so cool.
And it makes so much sense because in the old one, the sandworms are like on top of the sand.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
And
but this one, they're literally like surfing through. Like,
right. Water. It makes sense for them to be swimming through the sand.
Yeah. It's so cool. That's another thing that we need to cover very soon.
Yes. Yes. The first two parts. And so, yeah, you're correct. So I do see a third part coming out, but they pretty much covered that, like, for like the original, at least the original movie. I don't know about the book, but those first two parts covered the whole movie.
Yeah, so it's the first book that they covered, and that's what the first movie that the 1984 covered as well. Okay, let me look this up. Private Ryan, you ready to jump into our discussion?
But yeah, that's the biggest thing. Yeah, let's hop into some Saving Private Ryan. I know that you were probably intrigued that I decided to cover this movie.
Yeah, talk to me a little bit about like what drew you, because I haven't seen Saving Private Ryan since I was a kid, maybe in the early 2000s.
So I was going to bring that up. I'm actually so surprised that you have not seen that movie since, considering the fact that you enjoy Band of Brothers so much.
I know. And what's the funny thing about this, actually, I wanted to bring it up. In my head, whenever something was happening on screen, I had the Band of Brothers theme song in my head, like it was stuck. Even though like there was like other music playing in the movie, for whatever reason, like as I'm thinking, so I went for a run earlier today, just, you know, because I'm trying to get into shape a little bit. And in my head, I'm thinking about what I'm going to say for Saving Private Ryan on the show today. And in my head, the theme song for Band of Brothers comes on. And I'm just like, I cannot shake that stupid theme song. And it's a good piece of music. But yeah, the two are very connected.
Even though Band of Brothers is based off a book, which is obviously older.
And a true story. It's based on a true story.
Exactly. Saving Private Ryan walks so that Band of Brothers could run.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah, because Band of Brothers was after, right?
Yes. Saving Private Ryan is 1998, and Band of Brothers, I think it was 2001.
2001. You know your war movies, my dude, and war media. So,
well, I wanted to cover this because Saving Private Ryan is such a powerful movie, man. You know, even with it, if it's not a true story, and even obviously some things were shot in a specific way to make it more interesting than, you know, things were. Let me tell you, the opening for that Omaha Beach.
Oh, it kills me, man. It's such a hard thing to watch because it's like 20, 30 minutes of just people being slaughtered. And we know that's how it was. We know D-Day was one of the bloodiest battles ever.
Right.
You know?
And I actually looked it up. I was super intrigued because I'm pretty sure that Band of Brothers takes place in D-Day also, but it's the Airborne instead of the Rangers. But
yes. Yeah. So Band of Brothers was the Airborne versus, you know, these guys coming in through the sea.
Right. What was the worst of the fighting on D-Day? And Omaha Beach was by far the worst.
Oh, yeah. It was a slaughter.
You know, and that wasn't the only beachhead that they landed. There were a few other beachheads where they actually invaded at. But Omaha Beach was the worst because it was the most fortified. And, I mean, just you think about it, man. Like, they're already getting shot at while they're in the boats, you know, the landers. They're already getting shot at by mortars and artillery. And then as soon as they hit, like, it's just automatic machine gun fire, mortar fire, artillery fire. There was just no help from any tanks because there were barriers that were in the way. That's what those X's on the beach are. That's pretty much prevent tanks from getting on the beach.
Yeah.
And yeah, man, it's so powerful. But I love that the film doesn't start right off the rip with that. It starts off with an elder gentleman that we don't know, you know, hypothetically, we don't know who it is.
And you assume through watching it for the first time that it's actually this Tom Hanks character that you're following.
Right. Absolutely. And
there's there's similar shots throughout the movie. It zooms in on this elderly man's face to the point where you're looking at its eyes. And like later, maybe 10 minutes later, there's a shot of Tom Hanks' character, Captain Miller, with that same camera lens.
Yes.
So, and you're like looking at close into his eyes, you're like, oh, okay, so this is probably the same guy.
It's the classic Steven Spielberg stare.
Yeah, into the middle distance.
But it's just, it's so... it's insane that a movie that was made in 1998, and obviously they've done stuff to make it look good. If you would have told me that this movie came out in the 2000s, I would have believed you. Maybe, like, it could have come out at some point after that time, and I would have believed it, because it was shot so well, man. And, like, the cinematography was done so well, and the acting was really, really good. And you and I were talking about how this film, we got a lot of actors, like, pre whatever it was that made them popular.
Yeah, really quickly, before we jump into that, I just want to comment a little bit about, like, the Omaha Beach thing, just because of how crazy that scene is. That first, like, when they first dropped the ramp, and the machine gun, like, takes out literally almost everyone inside of that vehicle transport. Holy crap, man. It's like the Germans created the most perfect, like, turret defense game. You know, like, they set up their base in a way that, for, honestly, I'm surprised anyone got past, you know?
Right, yeah. Just, they called that opening the murder hole.
It's a murder hole. They're just being shot, like, you know, fish in a barrel.
Right, because you're standing, like, all pretty much grouped up, and there's only one way, you know. Oh, I mean, not one way, but, like, you're like, it's pretty much like a straight shot. I mean, you could jump over the sides, but yeah, it's a straight shot, like, in, you know?
Yeah. We mentioned Spielberg, obviously, was, you know, just did so well with the cinematography and everything. He actually won the Oscar for Best Director on that. And his cinematographer, Janusz Kaminski, won the Oscar for Best Cinematography.
Well deserved. I mean, that movie, it also shot so well.
It also won Best Effects, Sound Effects and Editing, Best Film Editing, and Best Sound. John Williams was nominated for Best Score, but he did not win. Which is fair. I don't, like I said, the score wasn't super memorable. I was actually thinking about a Band of Brothers for most of it. But
what is Unshakable? Because you said that it won Best Sounds. I mean, you can think about, like, that Omaha Beach and, like, the machine gun fire and all the explosions happening.
Dude, I get chills whenever I think about it.
That's literally all you heard. I mean, and, like, people trying to shout to one another. But all you heard was just machine gun fire and explosions, you know?
And I don't even think there's any music in that scene at all. I think it's just straight mayhem.
Yeah, it's just straight, yeah.
You know, people calling for their moms, people, like, holding up their guts, people
walking around with missing limbs, yeah. Like,
oh my gosh, it's such an insane, and it's powerful because it happened. This may be a remake, obviously, this may be fake, but it's based on something that actually did happen. And people who were World War II veterans, who were there, I remember reading way back when that they felt it. They felt that this was true and this was real to them. You know, like, this is how it felt in the war. Just the hopelessness. And
that's what they wanted to do with this film, was be historically accurate as far as that. And I do remember reading that and watching some interviews, and they're like, yeah, they're just, I think I had read something online that they said that they remember going to the movie theater with their grandfather, who went through that, and he had to actually leave because he had, like, a PTSD flare-up from it, because it reminded him of that time.
It's scary, man. The fact that this isn't that long ago, if you really think about it, it's like, this is, the World War II was, what, 70 years ago at this point? That's like two of our lifetimes and change, you know? It's really, that such chaos was committed, and, you know, lives were lost, like, in mass.
We were just talking about it a little bit also in the Godzilla episode that we did, how, like, soon after they made this movie, after World War II happened, you know?
Yeah, I'm having a hard time putting my thoughts into words here, just because it's something that's so hard to fathom, like, that basically the whole world went to war for 4 or 5 years, and, you know, just absolute chaos ensued, and tons of people died, more than any other war in history. And that's not even touching, like, the Holocaust, you know? Like, there was some crazy stuff going on in the 40s. But anyway, I digress. You were mentioning that, you know, that you have a lot of, like, not necessarily cameo appearances, but appearances of people who you would now see as cameo appearances because they're such big names in Hollywood, like Vin Diesel.
This was Vin Diesel pre-Fast and the Furious, man.
Was this Vin Diesel pre... Oh, what's his... Pitch Black?
Oh, Pitch Black. That's actually a good question. that was the first of the Chronicles of Riddick.
Yeah,
it is. Really,
is it before Pitch?
Pitch Black was 2000.
Okay, so yeah, he was a no-name actor pretty much at this point.
So yeah,
this is pre Triple X, pre Furious, definitely pre Guardians. So yeah, Vin Diesel as a character is just like, or as an actor is.
I keep on forgetting that he's in the Guardians. Yeah, because the Groot.
We are Groot.
Oh my goodness, it's so funny. But it's
Bryan Cranston pre Malcolm in the Middle, Nathan Fillion pre Firefly.
We got Ted Danson post Cheers.
Post Cheers, but pre most of his current work.
Was it
The Good Place?
Pre Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yeah, I'm looking through the list, man. Andrew Scott, who played Moriarty in the Sherlock series, was in it. Paul Giamatti, massive actor.
Yeah, Paul Giamatti. And then there's Matt Damon. He's not a cameo, the actual Private Ryan, but
Mr. Private Ryan.
This was before his Bourne Identity stuff.
Oh yeah, dude, this whole movie is filled with people. I'm sure it changed everyone's career, honestly. Giovanni Ribisi, he played the medic Wade. He's one of the lead bad guys in the Avatar series. Like, he's the RDA guy who is all after the unobtainium, the whole movie.
Oh my gosh, dude, what is that? You know, I didn't even put two and two together.
Well, that was you know, the Avatar movies were a previous obsession of mine before I got into MonsterVerse. So,
oh my gosh, that's crazy. Yeah, man. That
this movie was a huge boost to pretty much everyone's career, and it's understandable. Oh, and of course we have Tom Hanks.
Well, yeah, Tom Hanks.
There was one scene where he sounded just like Woody, and I couldn't shake it. Like, he started like being really animated, and it sounded like he was berating Buzz Lightyear. Like, you
that,
know, like
that
when,
was probably when
he, like, when
he was yelling at Vin Diesel for like they were gonna take. He wanted to take like that little girl down to like the next town.
Yes. Oh my god, what a... So it's interesting, actually. Let's talk about that scene, because you have this troupe who are, you know... Well, actually, we should probably take a step back. The whole point of the movie kind of stems around the idea that in the U.S. mailroom, wherever they're getting letters or sending letters out about, you know, this person is here, this person has died, this person, you know, instead of... Yeah, so basically one male lady in that office realized that three separate brothers, all belonging to this one mother's family, basically, have died in war pretty much all at the same time. The last brother, the fourth brother, James Francis Ryan, that's what it was, yeah. He's the last brother, and basically they decide, instead of letting him die, which he probably would have had their platoon not, you know, went over to grab him.
Dude,
basically,
yeah.
He would have absolutely died.
Yes.
Had they... But basically, like, the whole point of the movie is they get Tom Hanks' character, Captain Miller, and a group of soldiers who have, you know, a lot of experience at this point into the war. They send them on, like, a wild goose chase to find a Private Ryan. They go town to town, countryside to countryside, like, following basically hearsay. Oh, yes. I think there's a, you know, the 101st is over there. Oh, there's a James Ryan here.
Right. Like, it's not like they can pull up a phone, you know, they have radio systems and stuff there, but it's not like how it is nowadays, you know, it's still very, you know, just old school, you know, not exactly reliable. I mean, it was reliable enough, but you're not going to be able to find somebody. I mean, it would be hard to find somebody like that now, just even with the phones that we have. Can you imagine with just paper and radio sims and walking?
There was hundreds of thousands of men on all sides, you know, just walking around randomly shooting each other. I mean, it wasn't at random, obviously. They were obviously fighting strategic battles on different fronts, but it was... There's so many people that it could become very disorganized. And that's kind of the problem that they face throughout this, is that nobody knows where anyone is.
Well, I mean, and some random battles too. There's one that happens literally, like, they pass by a machine gun nest, you know, that happens, you know, it's like an ambush point, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's like, I would consider that like a random battle because that wasn't a mission for them. But Captain Miller was like, you know, we don't want to leave this here because they're going to ambush the next people. So yeah, no, I mean, with all that happening, it's tough. And one of the brothers dies on Omaha Beach.
Yeah, while watching it, I was just like, wait, Private Ryan is already dead, because we saw his the brother's logo on the back. But I realized soon that, oh, I must have been one of the other brothers. I was a little bit of a dummy for that. So you were talking about Vin Diesel's scene when they're in the town. They, you know, like they're mid fight, like there's like a battle going on, and these crazy parents who are probably just shell shocked, scared for their lives, scared for their children's lives,
in a building that's half destroyed,
think that they can give their kids to, you know, American soldiers for safety. And I obviously, we know that that's a dumb idea as an audience, but if you really try to put yourself into someone like that's shoes, they're probably so scared nothing makes sense anymore, you know. But Vin Diesel's character, Caparzo, he's already shown up to that point that he kind of thinks that he's immortal.
After surviving Omaha Beach, probably, yeah.
He has that scene where, like, they're under fire and he's just, like, biting into a bunch of apples, seeing which one is good enough to eat. And he's totally capable of being hit right there. But that just goes to show that he thought that he was invincible. Like, he didn't care at that point. So him taking the girl seemed like a good idea. Yeah, we could take her. It's no big deal. Obviously, he gets shot.
By a sniper, yep.
And it becomes this... The film adds another layer onto, you know, like, what it means to write letters home, or, like, to, you know, bring information back to your loved ones. And that he pulls out a letter that he wrote to his family, his father, I believe. He gives it to the medic to copy it onto a new paper because it's all bloody, basically.
Right.
And throughout the film...
That's such a strong scene, too, with... You get that moment with Jackson, the sniper.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's, dude, that was such a good scene. I think, like, snipers are just kind of just cool. And, like, I don't know how to describe it. Like, I don't want to say that, you know, warfare is cool, because it's not. But you'd have badasses on the field. And Jackson is a badass, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah. The way that...
That's what I'm trying to say, is that, like, when he needed to do something, he did it, in terms of, like, stepping up and taking out the guy who just killed Caparzo.
Right, right.
But yeah, one thing that I really liked, the attention to detail about the note that was passed between all the, you know, when Wade died, I forget who grabbed it from Wade, but basically the note kept getting passed around to all these different soldiers as, like, a, you know, in remembrance of Caparzo, basically, until they were able to send it to Caparzo's family. I think actually Private Ryan grabs it from Tom Hanks in the end, you know? But anyway, I thought that was a neat storytelling trick that they were able to utilize. This narrative of one brother dies, the next brother picks up carrying on their wish, carrying on their legacy. And that's so cool.
What are your thoughts on Corporal Upham?
Upham, yeah.
The interpreter.
Yeah, I believe his character is believable. You know, he's never really seen combat. He's new to war. He's never taken a life. And he's not a warmonger. You know, he's not someone who wants to get into battle. He's not someone who wants to take a life. And he's kind of like the level head throughout the movie. There's the one scene where they end up taking a German prisoner who, you know, they have, like, dig a hole for them to bury Wade in, I believe. And
yeah,
the rest of the crew basically want to kill this German prisoner, but Upham says, you know, that's not right. And it isn't right. You know, if he's a prisoner, he's a prisoner. If he's surrendered, he's surrendered. But they do have a point that, like, if we let him go, he's just going to fall back in line. You know, he's just going to...
Which ends up happening.
It ends up happening. In the credits of this movie, they call him... His character is named Steamboat Willie because he references American cartoons.
Steamboat Willie.
Yeah, so his... I'm looking
Isn't
at the...
Isn't it so crazy?
Like, I'm looking at the cast. I'm looking at the cast now. Steamboat Willie.
Isn't it crazy to think that Steamboat Willie is older than World War II?
Dude, it's nuts. It's so... Time is so weird, man. But yeah, they end up calling this guy Steamboat Willie. I don't think on camera they don't call him Steamboat Willie.
No,
but like,
no.
In the credits, he's labeled Steamboat Willie.
Well, we have to give him a name.
By the end of the movie, it's interesting because, you know, we initially see Upham fail to help Private Mellish, who's like right upstairs. He's having a knife fight with some German guy, and he has a panic attack on the stairwell, is incapable of bringing any ammunition to anyone, basically, in the whole fight. And he crumbles in battle. And
he did get shot at a few times, you know, during that fight. Like, you know, he was actually getting actively aimed at. So, I mean, I can imagine that being a part of it and just the chaos that was ensuing, people dying around him. You know, he had never experienced that up until that point, you know?
But then, of course, he sees, you know, like, he ends up in a position later in the battle where there are German prisoners. And one of those prisoners is Steamboat Willie. And that prisoner recognizes him and, you know, like, oh, hey, he's the guy that saved my life. And he immediately shoots him, which is, I believe, the first life that he takes in the movie.
Yeah, I believe so. He because you don't see him.
And it's almost like
even in all their engagements, he doesn't fight at all.
And it's a powerful scene because you're just like, whoa, what the heck happened to this guy? Like, what changed in him? And I think it's he lost his innocence. You know, I think that's it. Like, he's no longer, he has blood on his hands now because he was unable to help his brothers.
Well, he also just witnessed Steamboat Willie shooting Captain Miller.
Oh, of course. And so, but I think like on like a more,
I think there's a lot going on there, like in a way, because he doesn't do it immediately, but it's like, you know, I saved this man's life. He was a POW and he was saying all this stuff about, you know, screw Hitler and this and that. And
now he's now back here, fighting.
He's back fighting, you know? And that was essentially that's what they said. Like, oh, you know, they tell him to walk until he finds the first, like, you know, American, I guess, patrol. But then he was like, well, yeah, but what if he gets picked up by his own people? Then he's going to get cycled right back in. And sure enough, he gets cycled right back in into the Battle of Rommel, which is another, like, very powerful fight.
Let's cover the Battle of Rommel.
This one is really strong, too, because I feel like up until this point, you see, it kind of builds the human side of some of the characters up until then. But you get it a lot more in this battle. A lot of these people talk about, you know, their life before they joined the war, and it shows a bit, you know, some of the fears that they do have. I mean, Tom Hanks' character, that man is pretty much afraid all the time, you know?
Yeah, what is interesting is that, like, his shaking doesn't happen when he's in battle. His shaking happens when he's at rest, and it's almost like an anxiety thing, you know, like, when
it's
am
like
I going to do something? It's an anticipation jitter that he gets. But it's at Rommel that they find Private Ryan. You know, they're like, all right, bunch of our guys have died looking for you. Get over here, brat. We got some news for you, and you're going home, basically. And props to Private Ryan. He learned the news that his brothers had died, all three of his brothers. And he assessed the situation that he was currently in that if he leaves his post here, the brothers that he's made in this war will also die. And he basically comes to the decision that, like, no, I'm staying here till, you know, this bridge is fortified again. And Tom Hanks, Captain Miller, and his crew basically realize, like, all right, the only way that he's making it out of this alive is if we help them. And it's such a bloody battle. It's such a crazy, almost like 30-40 minute sequence of just, you know, the carnage of war. But
right, and
Spielberg, dude.
That was such a, you know, yeah, a lot of people in this group die,
including Captain Miller.
Right, yeah, Captain Miller. We have Upham survives.
Horvath dies.
Sergeant Horvath dies, which is like his right hand man.
Yeah.
And Mellish dies.
Yeah.
Jackson dies. Caparzo and Wade died prior to that. Wade died during that skirmish with the machine gun nest.
I'm pretty sure they all die, except for Upham.
Upham and Ryben.
Yes.
Gentlemen with the BAR.
What I really appreciate is that they go back to the gravesite. You know, Ryan has lived a life worth living. Basically, like, you know, before Captain Miller dies, he tells him
to
make
earn
it worth it.
Yeah, he said earn this.
And it's such a powerful idea. Like, what does it mean to earn? And basically, like, it shows that he's lived a nice long life. He has family, he has children, he has grandchildren, and they're all there to witness him paying his respects to these people who gave their lives so that he can live, you know? Imagine, like, the guilt you must have to live with after that. Or, like, the survivor's guilt. You know, like, why did I have to live? You know?
And you see it pours out of him, you know, in the beginning of the film. You know, he drops in front of, we don't know whose grave in the beginning it is, but yeah, you know, it's Private Ryan, this old man, you know, he's sobbing in front of the grave of Captain Miller. And, you know, a lot of it, you know, because, you know, Captain Miller just wanted to get home. He wanted to lay in his hammock while his wife was pruning the rose bushes and stuff. But, you know, it's like he gave his life so that essentially Private Ryan could have his own version of that.
Excellent movie. This is one of the best war movies ever made. If you guys haven't seen it, I'm sorry for spoiling everything, but
you had a long time to watch that movie.
It's definitely so worth it. But thank you guys so much for listening to us here for episode 73 of Project Geekology. My name is Dakota. I'm joined with Anthony, and we'll see you in, I believe, next week's episode, where we're covering Avatar The Last Airbender, right? The Netflix one.
The live action, because we already covered the cartoon. We haven't covered Korra.
Not the movie. We might touch on that a little bit, but not the movie. Anyway, guys, thank you so much. We hope you have a good day or a good night wherever you are. Please find our links to our socials in the show notes down below. And see you next time.
Bye.
Anthony, we did it. We didn't even have to make one Saving Ryan's Private joke. All right. Bye, guys.